I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking about U.S.-Russia relations and foreign policy, which seems timely in light of the recent Biden-Putin summit. Joining us to discuss these matters and more is Anatole Levin, a professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, and a new addition to the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, where he serves as the Senior Research Fellow and Expert on Russia and Europe. And with that introduction out of the way, let's get right to it with Anatole Levin. Welcome to Parallax Views, Anatole Levin, Senior Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute, specializing in the topic of Russia and Europe. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So I wanted to have you on the show because of the Biden-Putin summit that just happened. But first, maybe you could give my listeners a little bit of insight into your expertise on Russia and that region of the world and its relations with the U.S.
Well, I was posted to the Soviet Union, as it still was, by my then newspaper, The Times. I was a British journalist at the start of 1990, and I stayed there until the fall of 1996. So I covered the whole period of the Soviet collapse and the first years of the post-Soviet states. The first couple of years I was stationed in the Baltic states, so I covered their independence. Then I was in the Caucasus, and I covered the civil wars there. And then I was stationed in Moscow as correspondent. And on the basis of that, I wrote several books on different aspects of the Soviet collapse and the Russian experience after that, including one on the Russian-Ukrainian relationship. So that's the basis of my expertise on Russia.
So in regards to the Biden-Putin summit, I think the other important point before we get into the summit itself is, how did we get to this point where U.S.-Russia relations are so poor that people are really longing for, as you point out in one of your articles, U.S.-Russia relations during the Cold War?
Well, it's really two things, two things, basically. The first is that Russia has not been able to develop, as a Western-style liberal democracy, any kind of democracy, really. That's obviously mostly the effects of the lingering effects of Soviet rule. Most of the former Soviet republics, unfortunately, have not become democracies. But it does also have something to do with the dreadful effects of the Soviet collapse, the economic misery and chaos of the 1990s, and frankly, the way in which Russian liberals were discredited by their association with, what we call privatization, but which was in fact the theft of Russian, the people's property, the property of the Russian state by this partly the old Russian Soviet elites and partly new people, and a lot of the proceeds were transferred to the West, to Western banks, property in New York, London, Paris, and so on. And that really, so many of the people who the West supported in Russia, liberals, have never really recovered from that association with what happened in the 1990s. So that was the first thing. And so as a result, we have this dictatorship of Putin, which, you know, I mean, look, let's face it, it's not nearly as nasty as some dictatorships that we support around the world. It's not nearly as bad as Egypt. It's not nearly as bad as Saudi Arabia. But equally, you know, it's not Germany or France or Denmark, that's for sure. And so obviously this has created an alienation between America and Russia, between the West and Russia. But the second thing was that after the end of the Cold War, when Russia appeared to be so weak and chaotic that there was nothing it could do about it, the West, and particularly the USA, committed itself to the expansion of NATO and the European Union without ever drawing a line as to where this would stop. Except everyone knew it would stop with Russia, because, you know, we're not going to guarantee the Russian border with China. And while the Russians were prepared unwillingly to accept NATO expansion to Eastern Europe, because after all, you know, they let Poland and Hungary and places go in 1989, so in a certain sense, why should they care? Of course, once it's a question of taking countries next to Russia with territorial disputes with Russia into NATO, I mean, this caused a tremendous backlash in Russia. Because, you know, what it implied was, if we had taken Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, this implied that we would have sided with Georgia to expel Russian peacekeepers from these separatist republics that they're protecting in the Caucasus. And it implied that we would have expelled the Russian Navy from one of its most ancient bases at Sevastopol in Crimea and replaced it with an American, you know, military base. Well, you see, people talk the whole time about Putin, you know, Putin this, Putin that. The whole of the Russian establishment and a great majority of ordinary Russians, at least ones who take any interest in foreign affairs, are implacably opposed to that. And they often, you know, make the parallel. Look, whether by democratic means or not, any attempt by Central Asian, by Central American countries, Mexico, whatever, to join an anti-American alliance would meet a ruthless response from the United States. We know that. You know, it's happened before, right? No matter what the vote in Hawaii to leave the United States, and, you know, the closing down of Pearl Harbor, the prospect that that would become a Chinese naval base, America would go to war to prevent that. So, you know, there is this Russian real determination to make sure that countries that are of vital strategic interest to Russia and that have territorial disputes with Russia do not join NATO. So the sad thing is that, though, that this these two elements have been allowed to poison, or at least have cancelled out or obliterated other points where actually cooperation ought to be possible. You know, Russia and the West have a really strong interest in cooperating against Islamist terrorism. Both America and Russia have suffered terribly from it. We have the same interests in Afghanistan. You know, we both of us now accept that the Taliban have to have a share of power. Neither of us want the Taliban to have complete power. We both of us want, you know, to stop international terrorism returning to Afghanistan. And then, you know, at least in principle, we now agree on climate change. Now the Biden administration is there. But unfortunately, all of these other areas where we ought to be able to cooperate have also been squashed by this growing, you know, atmosphere of new Cold War.
So in regards to the Biden-Putin summit, what do you think were the biggest takeaways? Maybe what were the biggest hopeful takeaways we have from it so far?
Well, I think the best thing was simply the restoration of diplomacy. I mean, remember that, you know, prior to that, Biden called Putin a killer. the embassy, you know, the ambassadors were withdrawn on both sides, consulates were closed. It had really got to a point. And, you know, you saw this, of course, from not just Republicans, but quite a number of hardline Democrats as well. You had this ridiculous idea that even talking to Russia was somehow a concession. And as so many people pointed out, I mean, at that point, you can't talk to anybody. We couldn't have negotiated arms control agreements during the Cold War. I mean, for that matter, Reagan and Gorbachev couldn't have negotiated an end to the Cold War. You know, we couldn't talk to China about, you know, crucial reduction of tension. But now, you know, we've at least got back to the point where we can talk to the Russians about these things. That's the first thing. Secondly, I think, you know, we've restored the possibility of new nuclear arms control agreements. You know, Biden has extended START for another 5 years. You know, so now we can start negotiating that. And hopefully, though this is very complicated, you know, we might be able to work gradually towards an agreement on cyber security. You know, work towards drawing up certain, you know, regulations distinguishing between different kinds of cyber activity, and hopefully, you know, one day getting a common international treaty on cyber crime. I mean, that's some way. I mean, it's a long way away, but at least you know, you've got to start somewhere. So I think we've started that. But I think the most important thing from the summit is just that, you know, America and Russia are talking again.
I also, in that regard, since you mentioned the START treaty, I know there were issues actually between the Trump administration and Russia over the START treaty. And I think some people in the U.S. may gloss over that or not even know about it. But, you know, U.S.-Russia relations under Trump weren't necessarily all that great, despite what we often heard in, you know, the media here.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, Trump made some positive noises about Putin and Russia, but he didn't actually do anything. Now, whether he would have tried to do more if he hadn't been under, you know, this constant pressure of accusations of being in Putin's pocket, we don't know. But I mean, the simple fact is he did not do anything. He, you know, sanctions were intensified. NATO membership for Ukraine remains on the table. There was no effort to, you know, to resume the Ukrainian peace process. So no, I mean, he didn't do anything. I mean, it's Biden who's, you know, moved to restore relations again. Having, you know, and I suppose I can understand that. You know, Biden begins by putting down a really strong anti-Russian statement, and then that allows you, Washington being what it is, then actually to move to more pragmatic positions.
I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, within foreign policy circles, I think there's a real problem with having, you know, reasoned debate about U.S.-Russia relations. And what I mean by that is we had that row at the Atlantic Council about, I believe it was two researchers, experts, saying maybe we should focus on interests rather than human rights. And, you know, regardless what you think of that, I don't think anyone is saying human rights don't matter, but that there was no debate about it. There was just complete dismissal of that as propaganda. I was wondering if you could comment on that specific incident and how we view U.S.-Russia relations within foreign policy circles today.
Yes, well, I mean, it's become really poisonous. And you saw the same thing when, you know, there was talk of appointing Dr. Matthew Rojansky, you know, from the Kennan Institute to the Biden administration. And there was this really, I mean, almost McCarthyite campaign of vilification, accusing him of being, you know, Russian agent of influence. I mean, the point is, of course, that, look, of course America adjusts human rights issues to its national interest. We all know that. America does it with Saudi Arabia, obviously. It does it with Egypt, obviously, with Morocco, Algeria, India, you know, by now tremendous efforts to, you know, ignore the many crimes of Narendra Modi and his government.
I was going to say, even historically, although I hear things are changing now. I mean, our relationship with Turkey and, you know, sort of ignoring the Armenian genocide or not recognizing it. I mean, there's a lot of examples we can come up with.
Absolutely. But the problem is, of course, that when a country is being cast as an enemy, and this, you know, it goes back a long, long way, but particularly, of course, the Cold War, then there is an entire apparatus in America, which is, if you like, activated or remains, you know, active, using this as a weapon, frankly. National Endowment for Democracy, International Republican Institute, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Freedom House. And they, you know, this was the whole Cold War apparatus against the Soviet Union. And the thing is, I mean, during the Cold War, of course, this made a considerable measure of sense. You know, the Soviet Union was a real ideological adversary. And indeed, you know, American pressure on human rights in Eastern Europe played a part in bringing down the Soviet Union and liberating the countries of Eastern Europe. But now it's become, I mean, such an obstacle to thinking clearly about American interests. Because whenever you say, look, how on earth did America become so invested, you know, in the question of Georgian sovereignty over the Donbass, or, you know, or over Crimea, or why is NATO expansion in America's interest when obviously it would lead to huge new American commitments at a time when, you know, America is facing a much, much bigger challenge from China? And the thing is, you see, that on the other side, instead of people actually engaging with that and trying to say, is it in America's interest? Is it even in Ukraine's interest? Since, you know, I think we've demonstrated we won't fight for Ukraine. In the end, we will not fight to protect Ukraine. Instead, you get this response, ah, you're ignoring human rights, you're ignoring, you know, democracy and so forth. And that makes it very difficult to conduct a, you know, a reasonable discussion about just what American interests are, because it's immediately swamped by this highly emotional values, values based, I'm not so sure, but values expressed language of human rights and democracy. Now, I do have to say on that score, I'm getting very tired of listening to moralizing lectures, you know, about Russia, you know, from these people who have turned a blind eye throughout their lives to crimes in other places, you know, Central America amongst others. But also, you know, they go on and on about human rights and freedom of speech. And, you know, have they ever stood up for that in Washington itself? You know, have they ever taken in their lives, these people, taken a morally courageous stance over something that would make them unpopular within the American establishment? Never.
I was going to add to that. I often also wonder sometimes if taking a very paranoid and aggressive stance towards other countries, I think, can often create a very paranoid and aggressive stance in reaction that doesn't bode well for human rights in the countries where we express wanting to see human rights respected more. Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that's often ignored in Washington is the fact that, you know, our support for democratic and liberal dissidents and oppositionists in other countries can sometimes be deeply counterproductive, because it's allowed Putin and the regime in Tehran and the regime in China to accuse these people of being American agents. And it also, sometimes these people themselves fall into this trap. The Russian propaganda, I mean, Russian Putin government propaganda, you know, makes a big thing simply of replaying what certain Russian liberal oppositionists have said about Russia from the United States or, you know, or to American stations. Now, you know, we know Americans hate that. you know, when they see when they're criticized by foreigners. And no sensible American politician is ever going to do that, is ever going to, you know, take the stance of attacking America from another country. That's why, you know, Navalny, for example, I mean, obviously he's had to some extent appeal to us, very understandably, for protection, because otherwise he might well be dead, right? Assassinated by Putin. But on the other hand, he's always been very, very careful to present himself as a Russian patriot or nationalist, not as pro-American, as pro-Russian. Anti-Putin, for a whole set of very good reasons to do with corruption, oppression, what you like, but doing it from a Russian point of view and within Russia, not from an American-backed point of view, you see. Because after all, he's running for support among Russians. He's got to get, you know, you're running for votes in Russia, you know, in the Urals, not in the Midwest.
Before we wrap up, there were just maybe two more things I wanted to cover. Since we mentioned the Ukraine, for my audience, if they don't understand the issues with Ukraine and Russia and ultimately the U.S., what would you say are the flashpoints that people need to understand? Because I think it can get really confusing for the layperson.
Oh, God, I know. And I have every sympathy. You know, I obviously my job sometimes involves listening to or watching stuff about conflicts in Africa. I can't make head or tail of it. I can never remember who is who or what it's all about. I mean, I'd say just three things, basically. One is, got to understand, Russia is nervous about having, you know, NATO is a very anti-Russian organization, let's face it. They're nervous about Russia NATO approaching their borders, one. Secondly, the Russian speakers, many of them ethnic Russians, many of them Ukrainians who speak Russian in eastern Ukraine, are genuinely, it's not just encouraged by Russia, though it is, but they are genuinely very unhappy with this new ethnic nationalist regime set up in Kiev. They're not, at least it's difficult to tell from opinion polls, but in the past, at least, they didn't want independence from Ukraine or to actually join Russia, a majority, but they did want autonomy that would guarantee, you know, rights, language rights within their area. And that's the origins of the conflict in eastern Ukraine. In other words, of course, there's an element of Russian aggression, you know, Russian military presence, but there is also popular support for this. And the final thing is Crimea. Now, in Crimea, you undoubtedly had large majorities of the local population to join Russia. Russia has annexed it legally, according to Russia. It's never going back to Ukraine without a world war, you know, without actually America declaring war on Russia and invading Crimea to drive it out. It is as impossible that Russia would return Crimea to Ukraine as it is that, I don't know, India would give Kashmir to Pakistan. That's just, you know, no matter what law says, you know, and international law, and that is also, by the way, ambiguous, but it's never going to happen. Kosovo is never going to go back to Serbia. It's never going to happen. So I'm not saying, you know, we should recognize it, but there is no point in constantly pushing this issue. It's not going to get us anywhere. So, you know, ultimately, it's either just got to be shelved and forgotten about, or we need a diplomatic compromise. And actually, I mean, on eastern Ukraine, this was referred to in the summit by both sides. Russia and America are both committed to the Minsk Agreement 2015, which provides for autonomy for eastern Ukraine under international guarantees. The Ukrainian government is very unwilling to grant that, and America is not willing to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to push that through. But actually, I wrote a whole huge paper for this, on this for the Quincy. Actually, the basis of agreement on a peace settlement in eastern Ukraine is there. It's just a question of implementing it.
Now, do we have any examples? And I ask this specifically because of your latest piece in Responsible Statecraft. Do we have any examples of maybe lessons that we can learn from previous experience?
Well, I mean, that's the big risk, because I think the Biden administration has decided that it can basically kick this these issues down the road. You know, Ukraine is not strong enough to attack Russia, and Russia is not going to attack Ukraine and seize more territory. And I mean, actually, I'd say probably that's true. 2-1, if I had to put odds on it, 2-1, 3-1, that's true. But the problem is that, you know, as we saw in Georgia in 2008, as we saw in the Azeri attack on Nagorno-Karabakh in last year, these frozen conflicts can, you know, even many, many years later, can come unfrozen again with, you know, sometimes pretty disastrous results. You know, you think of other post-colonial crises, you know, it took, you know, I'm not saying there would be anything like that, but, you know, the Rwandan genocide, in many ways, it was set up by the way that Belgian rule ended. It didn't happen until 30 years later. It took 26 years after independence, for the Sri Lankan civil war to break out. You know, if you leave these things to fester, there's always the possibility they're going to explode at some stage in future. And I really would say that, you know, with not that I'm in favor of this new Cold War with China either, but, you know, undoubtedly there are real challenges from China, right? I mean, and real problems. And I just don't believe that, you know, America and the West can afford to have this sort of unexploded bomb ticking away in Ukraine. I think it would be better to try and defuse it.
That was the last thing I was going to ask about. Something I hear from, you know, I have listeners from all sides of the political spectrum, you know, left, centrist, right. I'm a little bit more to the progressive side, but I always like having listeners that will say, well, you know, we shouldn't be worried about what America does in foreign policy, because, you know, there isn't going to be a war with Russia or a war with China. It's not going to happen. So we should keep doing what we're doing. And I think that's a very oversimplified way to understand things. So how would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, if America was spending, you know, $50 billion a year or whatever, or proportionally to what other countries spend on defense, and if America had not been involved in two major wars, you know, over the past 20 years, and if America didn't have 640, I think, military establishments spread across the world, and if America, you know, wasn't sailing American warships past what China claims are its islands, and if America weren't moving towards almost a kind of security guarantee to Taiwan, I'd say sure. But I mean, I think that's the whole point. There's a real case. There's a really strong argument. You know, why should people in Kansas or Indiana care about what happens in Ukraine? I mean, actually, that's the point I'm making. You know, they shouldn't. It's not really important to them. But, you know, I think it was Trotsky who said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. In other words, you know, American taxpayers are spending proportionately huge amounts on the American military. There is, you know, if Taiwan declares independence, China will go to war. And what will America do then? In other words, this isn't cheap and it's not cost free. You know, America has found itself either dragged into in Afghanistan or because of the, you know, war of choice in Iraq. You know, two major wars over the past 20 years, which have cost trillions of dollars of taxpayers' money, you know, money taken out of the pocket of American taxpayers, going into American debt, which has to be paid off, paid to China, by the way, very largely, and thousands upon thousands of casualties, you know, American soldiers killed and maimed. You know, this foreign policy is not cost-free. And, you know, if one's going to care about how money is spent at home, well, you know, you ought to care about how American money is spent abroad as well, I reckon. And you certainly ought to care about American lives for God's sake. You know, it means thousands upon thousands of American soldiers coming back, you know, disabled for life with severe psychological problems. You know, that's the, and British ones too. I'm a Brit, as you will have gathered. And, you know, thousands of British soldiers too. I mean, it's our duty as citizens. You know, even if we don't give a damn about Ukraine or Afghanistan or Iraq, and frankly, I'm not sure why we should, but, you know, we do have a duty to care about the lives of our own soldiers. If you don't care about that, you're not a citizen.
So, in closing, what's the biggest point, maybe, that you want my listeners, if they've been listening raptly to this, and I certainly have, what do you want them to get out of this conversation?
Well, I think first, there's a great American foreign realist, very tough realist, very cold warrior, Hans Morgenthau, but he said the key duty of a statesman is, as opposed to any politician, is to be able to put yourself in the shoes of another country and see how they see the world and see your behavior. And you may decide they are such enemies that there's nothing to be done. You know, they genuinely are like Hitler or Stalin. But you may, if you do that, find that they are acting very much as you would react and act, as America would act in certain circumstances. So that's the first thing. You know, try to understand where they're coming from, because then maybe you can reach a compromise. And the second thing I would say is really think about the interests of the United States. You know, what are the real interests of America and Americans, ordinary Americans, in what goes on elsewhere? Is it worth it from your point of view, what America is doing in various parts of the world? And if not, then you should want American policy to be adjusted so that it does actually correspond to the interests of ordinary Americans and Brits.
I just wanted to add to that, and then I promise to let you go because I know you have another meeting, but I almost feel like sometimes people have forgotten about the importance of diplomacy and how important it was in the 20th century. I mean, if we were to, you know, throw diplomacy out the window and have a paranoid, aggressive stance towards all our nations to the point where we just, you know, completely throw out any possibility of relations with them, I think, you know, the 20th century would have been very, very much darker than it was.
Well, absolutely. You know, several times negotiations with the Soviet Union averted a nuclear catastrophe, you know, which would have basically ended the world. Negotiations with China, created a new balance which helped to end the Cold War, which isolated and brought down the Soviet Union, longer-term consequences. And, of course, American diplomacy with former enemies in Germany and Japan, you know, created NATO, you know, created the alliance which contained Soviet communism. You know, this wasn't just about American military power. You've got to be able to negotiate. The other thing is, you know, I think a lot of American attitudes were shaped at a time when, you know, after the Second World War, America had more than 50% of the entire GDP of the world. All the way into the 1970s, America and its closest allies had more than 80% of global GDP. Now we have 40%. If at that point, other countries are really important. And if you're going to get anywhere, and also in terms of defending America's interests, you've got to be prepared to negotiate, to compromise. Just as in, I mean, any businessman knows that, right? You know, unless you're Jeff Bezos, you don't control your entire world, right? There are adversaries out there. There are potential partners. You deal with them. That's what I'd say.
Well, I want to thank you, Anatol Levin, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work? And I just want to say that I'm glad you're working at the Quincy Institute. I've enjoyed your writings at Responsible Statecraft so far.
Thank you so much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Anatole Leon. Please be sure to check out his work at the Quincy Institute, and in particular, their publication, Responsible Statecraft. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.